Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
What's good, internet? Welcome to Waypoint Radio bonus podcast, God of War spoiler fest.
Oh, we're good we're at doing branding.
It. That's the, we don't have, what do we do with it? Because it's not a 101, right? I mean, I guess it isn't. It isn't a 101 for God of War. It's not enough of us here. We didn't, like, give people the time to play through it. Not enough distance, exactly. I was just explaining this to somebody. Somebody was like, you should do a Waypoint 101 for Mafia 3. And I was like, well, we covered that game when it came out. You can hear me talk about it. I really, 101 should have a little bit of distance with them. So,
well, there's like a history, like, and also, like, the consequences and ripple effects of,
yes.
of a game.
Yes.
Even if we don't necessarily talk a lot about that in a 101, I think that is definitely part of it.
Agreed.
Or like Fortnite, it's like the history is we missed it.
We missed it. We missed the history on it, and we're just catching up, finally.
It's new to us.
And so, in fact, if you missed that, that is now out on the feed. You can go back and listen to us talk about Fortnite for an hour or whatever. That was a fun one. That was actually an interesting entire process, I think, for us as people who normally, I don't say stay in our comfort zones, but like the world is busy enough and the games that come out are there's enough of them now. They are numerous enough that we can like find stuff to play that is really up our alley. You know what I mean? BattleTech is out. I could just have spent that time playing BattleTech. I could have just have spent that time playing, more Monster Hunter, stuff I know I like. And instead I was like, all right, we're going to spend that time playing a game that like I have mixed feelings about. And that was fun.
It's helpful that a game is multiplayer. Like you can put that list onto a number of people as opposed to, like I've been sitting here trying to figure out if I'm going to play Frostpunk or BattleTech, and the prospect of doing it on my own is like
that's
convincing.
A tough one.
Like, what if I just punt on it and just wait till State of Decay 2 is out, a game that I can wrap my head around?
That you can actually wrap your head around. I'm very excited for State of Decay 2. You should just join us for a tactical tour for a Mecha Monday one morning. Just like sit in, and we'll like walk you through what's going on.
Or maybe it should be the other way around. Where I should play BattleTech, and I can ask you questions about what I don't understand.
That might work. Yeah.
We'll think about it. Anyway.
We'll think about it. We'll figure it out. For now, though, we're going to talk about something that has zero robots in it, I think. I don't think there are any, like...
People are manipulated, but I don't...
Yeah.
There's no evidence of...
There's no, like, autonomous, like, tree mechs or anything, even. There aren't any, like... You know what I mean? Like, we don't even have any, like, golems. Or I guess there are frost elementals. They're elementals. Those things are robots. And, like, the ancients... Or whatever.
I guess like it's in terms, if you were to actually look at the elements of a robot, they'd function similarly. So.
Right, well, like, and they were made to do work, and, the dwarves, whatever, that's a robot. We got robots
right.
in this game.
So now we've justified why we're doing this podcast.
Finally. We're doing this podcast because it has been a couple of weeks now since God of War came out, because we are, you actually just wrote a piece on the site today. Did that go up last night? That went up today?
Yesterday. Well, when this goes up, I don't know. It went up on Monday on the website. Let's just say that.
About kind of the long tail of a reception, of a personal, kind of the personal read of a game. Something where, like, a lot of people think about reviews as being one and done, or like you do the review and then you wash your hands and you have your opinion is out there now. My review of the game is X out of 5 or whatever, and that is my final thoughts, the end. And your piece was kind of like, no, actually, like, I love engaging with criticism and, reviews and dialogue that happen after a game comes out, kind of the takes that represent a group of thinkers and responders and players who are not the sorts of people who tend to be assigned those reviews or have, staff writing jobs at major outlets. And we're now like moving into that moment of God of War, which is exciting
also,
for me.
Someone pointed out, cause I didn't get into it in my piece, but like, is what you're saying also giving yourself an out if an oh shit, I didn't notice that bad thing in the game? And I was like, yes, that is 100% what that is also about too. Because sometimes things come out and people notice a thing that like, I don't know, like you just didn't pick up on or just you looked at in a different way. And it's like, hey, I reserve the right to be like, yo, that was fucked up.
Right. Well, like there's definitely stuff. There's plenty of games that have stuff that I didn't catch the first time through. Like, I think there's a lot of really interesting discourse around writing criticism and fan videos and blah, blah, blah about like, Gwendolyn from Dark Souls 1. There's the boss fight in the long hallway. And then Dark Souls 3, there's the boss that just like, this is the worst. I feel like I'm failing as a Dark Souls fan.
I can't even help you because
Dark Sun Gwendolyn. There's lots of really great criticism around Dark Sun Gwendolyn as a trans character. The arguments are like pretty firmly grounded inside of the lore and like referencing item descriptions and referencing the ways in which other characters refer to Gwendolyn. That is really fascinating. And like, I didn't pick that up the first time through on Dark Souls, you know, like I didn't see the kind of trans reading of that character. And so like, I think all of us are better off when we enter a work and come out of it thinking like, yep, I missed stuff. What did I miss? Like, what's the thing that I missed? Whether that is like problematic content or if that is just, you know, interesting readings about stuff that I didn't pick up or that you didn't pick up, different perspectives.
You get caught up in the moment of I'm not sure how to articulate this, but like, so for example, like I didn't get this into my piece, but like the last Mario game, like I wrote a very glowing review of that. I did like it a lot.
Right.
And I think I ended part of that piece saying like, and I'm super excited to like get all of the extra stuff in this game in the months ahead. And you know what I haven't done is like turned on that game since I reviewed it. And I actually, the more distance I have from that game, like the worse I feel. Like in no world am I going to go turn on and be like, yo, that game sucked. That's not how I feel. But like certainly with distance, I have realized like I've better understood the things I liked and haven't liked about different games in the series, and that one actually landed in a place where in some ways I think I was arguing to myself that I liked it more than I did, because I always like these games. Like I always, and it's from it's the same Mario. Team that makes all the they've made just tremendous after tremendous game. And that's a game where, you know, 6 months later, I actually have cooled on quite a bit. It's a game that I still think is a tremendous accomplishment. A lot of things I like about it. But I have cooled on it tremendously since. And I just think that's something that is like, I think you ask a lot of reviewers, like how they feel about games that they were really, really high on in the moment. And then how they feel about them a year, 5 years, 10 years later. I would, you know, my own experience is not everyone's experience, but like, that's like the vast majority of those games that like you're super high on. Is that like later it cools to varying degrees, and your as your tastes shift or evolve, like you suddenly look back on it with a sort of like feeling about it.
I think especially in games where games also change so dramatically from year to year, from decade to decade. I mean, I think it's been even an interesting thing to see people who loved the old God of War games going back to those and saying like, oh, is there here? Like, is there, what did I like about these? Do these still hold up? Like, these sequences that seemed at the time to be so dramatic now seem so cheesy or whatever. And that wasn't that long ago. God of War 3 was like just over a decade ago, you know, like it wasn't that long ago in the history of a medium or something, you know? So, that has been fascinating. But anyway, we should kind of talk now, which is like, it's been a couple of weeks since your God of War review. It's been a couple of weeks since we talked a little bit about it on Waypoint Radio. And now we can talk about it. We're going to talk full spoilers here. We're going to go as deep in as we're going to go in.
No warnings. No warning. It's just at this point, that's your,
this is it. This is our warning. Here it is. In the next 10 seconds, we're going to start digging in and start talking about the game with no holds barred, you know? So I'm curious, Patrick. It's been a couple of weeks. Some other takes have started filtering out. You know, some other ones are still on their way because we're waiting on a couple. What do you think now? Like, how has it been sitting with you?
It's set pretty well. I think, like, watching... so, like, it was in the piece that I wrote, like, I referenced Bioshock Infinite as sort of kind of an aha moment for, I think, myself and a lot of other people about, like, how you think about a game, like, how critical discourse can help you understand the context of a game and your own readings of a game. But that part of Bioshock Infinite was that the story, like, that game was largely propped up, even if you enjoyed it and, like, took it for what it was, like, on the story and the world building, like, because the combat was really not much. There wasn't a lot to it. It wasn't particularly enjoyable. Like, the violence was, like, really indulgent in, like, a very old God of War sort of fashion. It was very not even in character for, like, the, you know, Booker DeWitt. Like, it just didn't make a lot of sense with the violence. And so, like, that game kind of fell apart on two planks for, I think, a lot of people, which is like, all right, well, once the story's been kicked out from under it, like, what do you have to sit with? And it really wasn't the mechanics of the game. Whereas, like, God of War, I think even the most critical reviews that I've read, like there were two really great pieces that I pointed people to at the end of my piece, which is Julie Muncy over at Wired wrote, like, a review that went up a couple of weeks after the game came out.
Right.
And then Garrett Martin over at Paste wrote a piece that functions largely as a review, even if it's not labeled as such, as more of an essay on the game. And, like, in both those instances, like, it seems like a lot of the discourse around the game has been like, yo, like, the combat's pretty great, and, like, that holds up really well, and it's a lot of fun to play. And then there's just, like, varying levels of, like, whether... it's basically the whether you accept the premise of the game. Like, and I think that's, like, the big, like, the hurdle. Like, I chose to take the game at its premise while critiquing, like, what that means. And then other people have just had trouble getting over that initial hump, which I also you either, like, buy into the idea that, like, this dude has a really awful fucking toxic history is allowed to or even should be granted the chance to become good or show that they have changed, or if that's a story even worth telling, given that it's an optional one and not a historical one. And for a lot of people, I mean, not a lot of people, but for, you know, some people that they just can't get over that. And it's like, I got other games I can play. I got other things that I can spend my time with. I don't need to see another one of these stories like this have been told before. Just because it's flashier and has, like, really, like, good combat doesn't necessarily make it worth telling. And but for me personally, like, I've still sat pretty well with the game. I think the thing that's soured for me is, like, I keep moving the point at which I get it's not the halfway point, but I think my review said, like, the last 5 hours are pretty rough. And then I think I keep in my head moving that back a little bit the longer it sits with me. I mean, it's definitely, like, the last, I don't know, fourth of the game is a complete tonal and...
Where's that point for you? What's the moment that it starts to lose itself?
I'd have to go back, like, because I recorded most of my gameplay and I was scrubbing through it trying to figure out, because there was just a moment where, like, I think the game actually comments on it where, I can't remember the character's name of the head that you're holding.
What is his name? It has already been too long.
It's long enough for me to forget, like, the B tier characters.
Yeah.
Whatever. The head that you're holding, who often acts as, like, a character who knows as much as Kratos, but ends up verbalizing it because Atreus just, you know, is learning as he goes along. That's a big, you know, arc of the game. Like, you go in, you're bringing, like, another thing so you can get to Jotunheim, and it doesn't work, and then, like, he says something on the lines of, like, oh, basically, like, what the fuck? Like, again? Like, we gotta go find something else? And,
yeah.
And then I was like, yo, game, like, you shouldn't be... Don't verbalize the feeling that you think your player might be having if that's a bad feeling to have. And that was to the point where I was trying to figure out... and this is difficult in the review, is like, okay, am I feeling this tension because I'm looking at the clock on how long I have left in this game, how long I have to write this review, get all the other things ready for this game so that I can, like, write something substantial and interesting? Or is the game actually paced poorly? They're forcing it. They should have cut, like, the last at least, like, 5 hours from this game. And the longer I've sat with it, the more I feel very confident in saying, like, I really wish they'd gotten rid of... it feels weird saying this after having seen a movie about six MacGuffins, but they should have gotten rid of the MacGuffins at the end of God of War and streamlined the ending. Because I do think, for all the game's problems, for all the game's lack of reckoning with sort of its history of misogyny and sexual violence, like, if you take the game's journey at its sort of, like, face value of, like, trying to fulfill the wishes of Kratos' wife and Atreus' mother, like the ending of the game, like the moment where they like reach Jotunheim and like have the moment with their ashes, like is I think like a really strong emotional moment for the game, but one that was deeply undercut by the fact that it took so long to get there, and especially because I thought the game for the first, I don't know, like 10, 15 hours, like for as long as that seems, and as someone that constantly rails on games for being too long and not cutting their fluff, like felt like pretty tight, and like I wasn't complaining about where the storytelling was going, but then it just seemed like, ugh, like really? Like, bleh. And it really took a lot of the, it took too long to get there. And though, even though I found that moment to be like cathartic and well done, it took, because of the sheer length, it wasn't able to sell it as much as it should have been.
Yeah, for me, by the time I got there, I was like so off board and was not, I didn't like the kind of climax of that game, which is the big final fight with Baldur and Freya. I think that scene is just not, I think as a fight, I think as a gameplay, like boss fight, it's like I've fought this guy three times now and these fights are not, this is just redoing mechanics from previous fights. But
I think the first one was good and then they did it two more times.
They did it two more times, and also it uses stuff from the Magni Modi fight also, the kind of like slow turn facing thing. But then, like, narratively, like, I really don't like what happens with Freya as the only woman in that game with a voice who isn't a side optional Valkyrie boss fight. To, like, have the only woman in that game be an overprotective, abusive mother is, like, whew, that's a choice to make, you know?
Well, if you're gonna go there, you've got, for a game as long as it is, you know, they don't give any time for that story to breathe, right?
And
if you're going to go there, like you have to give these characters arcs, and like they originally, it's not earned. Like it's rushed at the very end, like to give like backstory and meaning to like the conflict between Baldur and Freya, and like the original moment that you have where when you're in
you're in hell when you see
hell, the underworld, and you have that moment where it's revealed why Baldur is so angry and upset with his mother.
And why, like, he's invincible, why he's immortal.
Why he's invincible. And it's actually like a like pretty well, like for like a exposition dump, like it's handled like pretty well, like contextually for like a reason that you would be sitting and just kind of watching. I think like you're climbing over around him to get to the, you know, the ship that you're using to try and get out of the underworld. And it adds it gives a little bit of sympathy to like Baldur as a character.
We don't see him before that moment. All we ever see of him is as an asshole, and then we see Freya being like, "I don't like." We get a line of dialogue about how he's like a partier, basically. Like he's out fighting, killing people, drinking, having sex, and she's like, "Your life is super dangerous. I don't want you to get hurt anymore. So now you can't feel anything." And it is just like it feels like such a. I mean, there's two things. One is, when you only have one woman in the game, it puts a lot of pressure on her to represent femininity and to represent women in general, whereas we have this broad array of men to look at. We have Sindri and
there
Brock.
There are two women. You're carrying around the ashes for the entire game. She's there, Austin.
Uh-huh. So actually there's a question that we got that came in that kind of hits on this. Let me pull it up really quick because you're right. There is also Faye, who is the other
double. They couldn't even give. You know, they both had to start their names with F. Like, come on, Sony Santa Monica.
I think that both of them come from a particular myth. I know for a fact that with Freya, they actually do. So you notice that she's both Frigga or Frigg and also Freya. That is a collapsing of two characters in Norse mythology that some theorists or academics think could have had a similar origin or might overlap. Like, that is a reading of the characters of Frigg and Freya, but in a game where there's only one woman character, it's again like, oh, you actually could have had Frigg, who is this one type of Norse god, who I think was an Aesir, and then Freya, who is a Vanir or whatever, right? Like, you could have done those two different things. In any case, this one comes in from Charlie. The more the game went on, the more I felt the absence of the wife character. We find out so much about her through the game, but could the game have benefited from actually including her more as a character? The series at large has never depicted women very well, but for all of the quote-unquote maturity this God of War reboot goes for, it does feel that women are once again underrepresented, Freya in particular. I think it points to the truth that narrative designers haven't really matured themselves. In fact, there seems to be a glaring lack of insight. And then, as an extension of that, like, when do we get the mom version of this game instead, where we have the character who is like, where we are getting the Freya character, right? Because weirdly, the message of this game for me gets kind of really muted and there's a sort of centrism of parenting at work, right? Where it's like, well, you can't be a Kratos.
Go on.
You can't be a Kratos who is like a mean dad, but you can't be the overprotective mom either. Like, this is what toxic masculinity and like abusive motherhood look like. You got to find the right middle ground, which is like, you know, a one-armed hug. And like, that is it. So I do think that, like,
I mean, like, they do say that, like, although Atreus is not a killing machine when they are introduced, that there are like lines of dialogue that suggest like she was training him to hunt, that like she was, I mean, she was not a murderous rage machine, but that, you know, she wasn't oblivious to the fact that Atreus would have to like go out, well, fend for himself.
And the final reveal is that she in fact was hiding things from them, right. Hiding her own heritage as a giant and hiding the knowledge of this prophecy or whatever cyclical time Norse stuff. But it is one of those things where it's just like, all you needed was to actually embody Faye a couple of times. We see other characters embodied who are not physically there. We see Athena show up. We see Zeus show up. We see...
That's when I thought they were going to do it. Like, when you were in Hell, it seemed like, oh, this is when there's going to... Even if Atreus doesn't get a chance to talk to his mother, like, Kratos will have... Like, maybe they could, like basically put it into, like, a scene or two where Kratos at least, like... talks to her, and that ends up as being some sort of way of not only giving her voice into the story, but recognizing and acknowledging like other parts of the series canon that the game like basically like ignores or doesn't want to talk about in this game. And they just choose, despite having like the narrative contextual narrative reason, and one that they deploy through, you know, other means. I mean, I guess if you want to get like, you know, hyper specific, like the things you're haunted, that's the only things you see in Hell are the things you're haunted by. But like, what the fuck ever? Like, you can be haunted by the death of your wife and, you know, find a reason to bring her into the story. I think they have this bit where, you know, Atreus sees Kratos, like, you know, beating the shit out of Zeus's face. Like, right. One of the most, the series has a lot of violent moments. And like, if you have not played God of War 3, like, go fucking watch a YouTube clip of Kratos beating the crap out of Zeus towards the end of that game. It's both horribly grotesque and also it's mechanically interesting, because in that moment, like, the way that like beating things up in these games usually works is that you tap the buttons until, you know, it triggers the cutscene and then you move on. And in that sequence, they never actually stop until you stop.
Right.
And so if you like, there are YouTube videos where like, watch Kratos bash Zeus's face for 10 minutes because the game just won't stop until you physically stop pressing the buttons, which in a much smarter game, that would have been like a really interesting like trick to deploy based on, you know, about player agency. But, you know, God of War 3 did not.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
No. Well, and so like that's I think part of the thing here too is the Freya climax, which is, you know, Baldur arrives at a twist of fate because of the mistletoe, which is tied to which is from the actual myth. Mistletoe is the thing that Baldur is weak to for some reason. Baldur loses his invincibility. He starts to be able to feel again. And in that moment decides like, all right, well, I mean, he's already decided he's going to go kill his mom. He's going to go kill Freya. And we get this like very rough fight sequence, which is Freya being like, yo, stop trying to kill each other. Like whatever happens, happens. I am good. I'm ready to face this thing. Stop trying to kill my son. And you and Atreus, Kratos and Atreus being like, no, stop it. Don't let this guy kill you. We're going to hold him down and beat the shit out of him. There's actually a couple moments in there where, like, I did not hit him. Like, there's a moment where you get to hold Baldur down, and I did not hit the punch button because I was really curious what would happen. And it just you just hold him there. You just hold him there for, like, 30 seconds, and then the fight continues. And then it's just like, oh, no, he shakes you off finally, and you get to keep fighting. And he moves on to the next phase.
Yeah, I beat him up.
Totally. right. So I didn't, because I was like, all right, Freya's like, chill. I'm going to chill. Like, we'll hold him down. Let's talk it out. All right, let's go through some magic shit. Let's go find another MacGuffin that lets us all be able to have a conversation about our fuck-ups. That did
especially
not-
just like Freya, you know, during the sequences where you head back to her, you know, house under the turtle, which I'll side note, like that turtle, the first time you see the turtle and it rises
it's
up,
it's a cool turtle.
Oh my god, just like, a really a cool fucking turtle sequence in the game. She comes across as like a very pragmatic and like thoughtful, and like the way that like she's like when she kind of gets on to what Kratos's like bullshit is, it's like, yo, you're fucking up, and like you need to like come to terms with like the reality of your situation and like the harm you're doing to your son by not giving him the full scope of like who he is and who you are.
Right.
And it just, now granted, obviously it's probably a lot easier, you know, as a parent, I'm like slowly learning this. It's a lot easier to give other people advice about what you should do than to take that advice and deploy it into your own life. That said, like the way she turns into like a stereotypical, like shrilling, overprotective mom at the end, like also it both undermines the character that's presented,
right?
And they don't do enough background with her and Baldur, and that is like it. There's reason to believe it would be a problem no matter how they arrived at it, but like, by not even giving the character enough time to move in that direction for you to understand the history of the character, that relationship. It's like they give it all of. There's so much talking in this game, and lots of good talking.
Yep.
But you get what, maybe 5 minutes total
with those two characters. Like, you get stuff through Mimir, who's the head, whose name I looked up.
There you go.
You get Mimir, who talks about Freya and Odin and their relationship kind of falling apart, and kind of Freya doubting all gods and blah 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 blah. Like, you do get some of that stuff, but what you don't get is like, in what world is it where Baldur is, like, worse as a person than... This is Richard. Richard wrote in, a fan of ours wrote in to say, like, Kratos killing Baldur is framed as a tough thing, but right thing to do in the game. But Baldur's crimes are way less bad than Kratos's, and the entire game is about Kratos being an okay person. The entire game is about how Kratos gets to have his redemption arc. He gets to have been the Baldur character and still be able to move forward and, like, find his rightness again. We don't get that from Baldur. Like, I'm not asking for a Baldur redemption arc. What I'm asking for is like some sort of reckoning with Kratos's historical misogyny and abuse against women and just like general shittiness in a way that accounts for Baldur being his foil there instead of just being an antagonist, right? Like, those conversations are not there, but by the grace of the gods go I. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not even like, oh, I don't want to look like Baldur to my son. And in fact, part of the thing that was so tough for me was that final fight with Baldur is a moment of synthesis for this game and its two contrasting positions, right? Throughout that game, what we have is Kratos on one side and Atreus on the other. Kratos is all action, and Atreus is all reaction and thought, right? Kratos is you know, all about close your heart, he says, right? Over and over again, close your heart to it. He's all about, having a single thing he's focused on and not stopping to help people along the way. Atreus is constantly pushing to help other people. And eventually that switches a little bit, and then they kind of pivot it when Atreus finds out he's a god, and even though he's been raised and taught by both of his parents that the gods fucking suck, he immediately is like, I'm a god now, fuck y'all, I'm a teenager. But in the end, the kind of synthesis of those positions is like this sort of like, oh, we need to be powerful, but also wise. And we see Atreus like turning into action movie Atreus in the fight scene against Baldur at the end, where he's like doing a cool flip and he's like flying through the air and shooting the arrow downwards as they fall off the giant. And like all of that stuff represented to me like, oh, this is supposed to be like Atreus is not final form, but like, you know what I mean? Like we found him. He's the right, these two positions have come together. And now this is what a good father-son relationship looks like, killing this other son. And it landed really flat for me, actually, for a similar reason to the kind of the stuff we talked about in the Black Panther Waypoint 101, which was that it feels like it defangs much of Atreus's very sharp criticism of Kratos throughout the game by finding this middle ground position that says, like, oh, sometimes you have to, even though someone says, like, don't interfere and help me, you have to kill their son anyway. Like, even when someone else is saying, like, no, I care too much about this child for you to hurt him, like, you gotta step in sometimes. And there's even that, like, throwaway bit afterwards where Mimir is like, well, you know, maybe there was no right answer here, shrug. But for the player, the right answer was killing him because there wasn't another answer. There was no other way to do anything there.
And yeah, that you don't was have just any agency over the moment. Not that I expect agency to be at every presented in a game like this, or then you're so heavily reliant on the story that the writers are here to tell, that even if it feels at odds with the very story that they've pitched, you don't have any say in seeing it go some other way. You're at the whims of how they've chosen to present that.
And right.
That line that Mimir has like feels very like. It's very similar to like the way like the Simpsons have responded to like Apu is like what do you do when like you have this like problematic fucked up character? I don't know,
tough one.
Things are the way they are.
They are the way they are.
I guess.
Yeah.
Granted, like Mimir, like even when he says that line, like I don't believe I don't think he believes that because like he shows an awareness throughout the entire game that is just like. Y'all are fucked up.
Do you think Mimir is Mimir? Do you think there's a secret there? Emmanuel from Motherboard and I were talking about this the other day.
It never crossed my mind. What's the theory?
He's Odin. That he's Odin and his mind has been wiped. The way that he can't remember other things about Baldur. He's like, he has one eye, which is Odin one eye. Odin has one eye. And that like the other gods have like tortured him and tied him up and have mind, like have messed up his mind. And that he's not in fact like a British fey guy who like fell into this world. That's one of the many interesting theories I've heard about this.
How do you square that with him getting the giant's eyes? Did Odin get the giant's eyes as well? I know the two people in Mimir eventually reveals that there are two people that got the eyes of the giants.
It's Tyr. And the answer is just like time is cyclical and weird, right?
Okay.
I'm still pretty confident that Kratos is Tyr. Kratos or Atreus will grow up to be Tyr. Tyr was like one of the earliest Norse gods and is the god of like war and justice in Norse mythology. Okay. And I'm pretty and the fact that Tyr's whole thing is like, I went to Egypt, I went to Japan, I went to the other places in like beyond the Norse realms. Like you go through all.
Well, that's actually part of like Tyr's like fiction
in the game.
Are you saying that's part of Kratos?
Tyr's vault and all that, you see that like, oh, there's just like a sarcophagus here. He just has like a sphinx and like a pyramid. And
yeah,
and
there was, and there's some like throwaway line where like there was some interactable that it was like, oh, what are those? And it's like, oh, that's from a land far away from here.
Right. And he has the wine. He has the wine from the Greeks. And I was like, it's so easy for me to imagine, given the weird cyclical nature of the Norse mythology stuff, where it's like, oh yeah, the end of days is coming, and also it already happened, and the wolves are chasing the sun, and also they already ate it, you know, that one of those characters
the whole reason that the world
serpent.
World Serpent is even there is because Ragnarok already happened. Right. Ragnarok needed to happen for the World Serpent to appear, but the World Serpent appears before Ragnarok already happened.
Yeah, totally.
Because that's just the way it works. Cool.
I actually like that stuff. And almost, we got a really good question in about that. About
which was more explicit because I don't think it lays it out like the way you pick up on some of it. And if you're familiar with Norse mythology, maybe you start connecting some things in a way that like makes maybe what they're proposing or the context they're putting the story in a little bit more interesting.
Right.
Because even you just laying out there, I was like, oh, right, okay.
Right.
anyway.
This one came in from Neil, who says, I just finished the game today, and while I quite liked it, I was left really cold by how badly the stories of Norse mythology were incorporated into the plot. They threw a lot of names of gods, giants, and dwarves around, but the writers didn't seem to capture any of the flavor of melancholy and loss that is everywhere in Norse mythos. The gods are untrustworthy and are no better than people, but also have the full knowledge of their impending destruction. This seems ripe for the telling of an interesting God of War story, but they don't even seem to try. Did you feel the setting of the game was really just set dressing for the father-son storyline? What games do you like that successfully incorporate the environment of the game into the storytelling? I definitely think the center point of this game is the father-son story, right? Like, and there was definitely some cool stuff that I know is drawn from the Norse mythology stuff, but it did not. I definitely left wishing I'd had more.
It still feels like very much like window dressing.
Yeah. I wanted more because that stuff is fascinating.
But and it seemed, and certainly the way they end the game, it's sort of unavoidable that they're not going to be able to, they're going to have to dive concretely into some of this stuff. But it seemed like there was definitely trying to pull back on, like, whereas God of War 3, God of War 2, I mean, all the God of War games, like, were so steeped in that stuff to the point where every big fight was just like, what's the next big spectacle that they're going to pull from Greek mythology? And this one was like, okay, Norse gets us away from the stuff that we've, well, probably already killed. killed most of it at this point.
Yeah.
The whole pantheon is dead. But also just, like, I mean, there are very few, like, big spectacle moments like that. Like, when the sequence of the dragon happens, like, it feels like it gets a little extra oomph because there aren't a lot of those. Although I also ended the game, I think we talked about this in our conversation before, like, wishing there was a little bit more of that, because they are, like, really thrilling. And I guess it's better to want more than to want less, but I do think they could have pushed it a little further. And I think they could have, in that same thing, I think they went so far in the other direction of trying to remove them from all of that spectacle and mythology that you could have learned something more about the world that they were in. They could have done more with that in a way that I don't think would have necessarily compromised what they were trying to avoid, but would have, like, I'm not sure you come out of playing this new God of War actually knowing very much about Norse mythology.
No.
As someone that, like, falls into what I'm guessing is probably, like, a lot of people, which is, like, growing up just where there was an more innate familiarity with Greek mythology. That was just something that came up, either whether it was pop culture, osmosis, or just the kind of stories that were around. Like, I learned a lot more, knew a lot more from Greek mythology than I ever did about Norse. Like, I came into God of War actually kind of interested because, all right, like, I know here and there about Norse, but it's just not, you know, like, what I know about Norse mythology, like, probably has more to do with, like, offhand references from the Marvel Cinematic Universe over the last 10 years.
Right.
And that may be true for a lot of people, I think. And, like, God of War, like, had an opportunity to do more of a deep dive. And, like, I think the extra information you get in this game, like, the codex that they do isn't particularly good at, like, giving you extra information about the world. I think Atreus' writing, I'm not going to profess to necessarily claim how well it represents what a 7-year-old whose writing it is, but all I know is I checked his writing like once or twice and then just went, none of this is interesting or enlightening, I'm just going to stop reading these things.
I checked it for the, like, murals to make sure I understood what the murals were about afterwards, like, whatever his little, like, 12-word summary was.
Yeah.
And that stuff wasn't great. The stuff that I will say was solid for me, at least, was the bit dialogue between places, like, as you went from place to place. Mm-hmm. To the degree that, like, I mean, so again, someone wrote in and basically said, like, was anyone surprised by how funny this game was, actually? And for me, most of the humor was in the, sort of the conversations bit by bit, like, on your way between places. Alex James writes in and says, my question for both of you is, did either of you find the game to be funnier than you initially expected? It might just be my dry sense of humor, but I unexpectedly found God of War to be one of the funniest games I've played in a long time. From Kratos' horrendously bad stories, his bluntness with every other character in the game, including Atreus, the banter between the dwarves, both while they're apart and while they're together, and the amazing integration of Mimir's storytelling, I found myself laughing throughout the entire game. And I definitely had that, and I think in general, some of the best characterization and some of the best humor is the boat stuff, is the, like, Kratos trying to tell Aesop's fables? Is Mimir kind of giving you context for the various murals you found around the way? All of that sort of stuff, one, felt like it had a little bit lighter of a hand, a little bit less of a melodramatic hand on the characters. And then, I mean, obviously, right, because it's not the big story moments where you have to be really zeroed in on.
It felt like the equivalent of, like, sitting, like, in another game would be, like, sitting around the campfire.
Yes.
And then you're getting a couple of these side stories to give you a larger context. And instead, like, I think one of the things to take away from this game that I hope more developers study is the way that they do exposition dumps without making them feel like what they do is world building.
Yeah.
Like, exposition dumps are world building done poorly. Like, it's the equivalent of finding audio logs and, like, people writing notes that don't make any sense for them to have written down. And God of War has thousands of lines related to building up the world.
The way the gods work, the wars between the gods and the giants, the division between Aesir and Vanir, like, all that stuff. And the way that they do it is they actually make it really digestible by turning all of those stories into bite-sized stories that are told to you via Mimir's, like, oh, let me tell you about the time that the World Serpent and Thor fought, or will
fight. And they're conversational, too. Yes. Like, even, like, the cadence, the way they are told makes them seem approachable in a way that, like, for example, it's made sacrilege to a person like yourself that probably enjoys stuff of this, but, like, in the Elder Scrolls games, like, it's cool that, like, you can pick up these books and, like, read about the history of this world, and in theory, I think that's really cool, and then I go to read them, and I get two pages in, I'm like, I'm not looking at this. I mean, I play Skyrim for like 150 hours, and like I maybe spent, you know, like 90 seconds in one of those books, and like missed out on probably a lot of really cool storytelling. But the presentation, like, just, it didn't engage me in a way that, one, I didn't want to pause. I guess I'm not a huge fan of like pausing and reading codexes. Like, I like it when it's a separate app or something like that. It's like, oh, with my spare time, maybe I want to. I think Mass Effect did something like
that. Mass Effect 3 definitely made the codex external. Yeah, it was in like the iPad app that you also used to play that game.
Stuff like that is neat. It's not usually, I don't like to do that in game. I know there's a big criticism of Destiny was that, like, hey, like a lot of the cool storytelling is happening, you know,
outside
of the game. But there's no, it was in the game, and there was like, could you access it in game?
No, you couldn't. You couldn't access those cards in the game. That's the worst thing. So you couldn't that.
I guess long story short is that they found a really smart ways of doing a lot of world building that I wish more games would think about finding. Like, they integrated into a character who makes sense to be a storyteller.
Right.
And then it doesn't feel forced. It feels like very much like this is what you would do in boring parts of the game when you're going from point A to point B. I still think it is complete bullshit that you don't unlock actual fast travel in this game until you beat it. Like, I actually thought my game was glitched when it's like, oh, why can't I just jump between the portals? Why is it only that I can go from a portal back to the main hub and not back again? And then when it unlocked after I beat it, I was like, oh, they were just saving that for the end. But it's just, they should have unlocked that a lot sooner because there was like side stuff that I could have gotten to faster, or it was just one of the small things that bothered me. But that all feeds into things we've talked about before about how they handle, like, you know, the cutting off of conversations.
That's like one of those decisions I will support in terms, even though I didn't like it, it's like, all right, I want there to be a world where you can have idiosyncratic games that have things like that as a primary decision of, like, no, we always want there to be room for these side conversations to be happening. We don't want to cut, blah, blah, blah. Even though it didn't really affect me much, or even though I would prefer that they didn't do that, I'll defend to the death your right to have a fucking long loading. Like, I'm the Dragon's Dogma guy, you know? Like, it's who I am. I will say there, though, that as kind of an extension on that, I do wish that some of the side stuff had, it ended up being, at the beginning of the game, the conversations that were between side things were like, oh man, I can't wait to stop and, like, listen. I'm totally happy to stop and listen to the side stuff because it's really cool. But by the end of that game, it was like, I wish you would just keep telling the story in the background while I'm killing these nonsense ghosts or whatever, because I don't care about killing these ghosts. I'm just trying to clear up some side shit and see if anything cool happens. I'm just trying to light all these braziers to see if it does anything. I don't care about fighting these mini bosses at this point. Just
it would have been neat if the game at some point had Mimir say, like, hey, like, why don't we just, like, keep talking where you could have hit, like, some button that's like, yeah, just keep going.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Cool.
Totally. Let me do another question really quick. This one comes in from Natasha, who says, Could you touch on the specific representation of masculinity in the game and the surrounding male reception of it in among game critics? Specifically, it seems as if Kratos' character holds fascist tendencies with some of the lessons that he implicitly and explicitly conveys to his son. In one moment, he tells Atreus to, quote, close his heart to the violence and pain they are inflicting on their enemies, quote unquote. In another, he uses the Aesop table of the thief and the mother to illustrate that pain and punishment are necessary to grow strong children, which is something that previous fascist movements throughout history also employ to reinforce their ideology. Then, I wondered if you could contextualize this representation of masculinity with how many male game critics have responded positively to the narrative of the game, with how, quote, mature it is, and how much they're able to relate and reflect themselves in Kratos' struggle as a father. I know Patrick has professed that he found himself able to relate to the fatherhood theme of the game, so maybe he has some thoughts on how he and possibly other male critics found something to relate to within Kratos. Personally, among my male friends, we highly think this character is bordering on fascist with moral values he's conveying, and of course is a symptom of toxic masculinity. It is worrying for us to see how many male critics and gamers who say they can relate to him. It's actually really scary and frightening that anyone can reflect themselves in Kratos. And then finally. Well, actually, we'll go to the second part later, because I think this is another question that we should get to. But for me, I think when I read that stuff, what I mostly see – I mean, so speaking for myself, as I mentioned in the previous episode of Waypoint Radio, I definitely related way more to Atreus than Kratos in terms of having a father who, as a child, I was scared of and who I had to learn how to develop a certain relationship with and who saw his father confront his own history of toxicity and violence and abuse. And who grew as a person. And I suspect that, and from what I've read from talking to you, Patrick, and from talking to some other people who've played the game, the thing that's being related to is that the game's arc is about Kratos learning to hug his son and, like, learning how to become a softer character, which is, I think, a totally fair thing to critique. One, how he gets there, which is mostly by learning how to kill things with his son. And two is, like, do we tell that story? What's the value of telling the Kratos story here instead of the Atreus story first and foremost, or right, from that perspective, or as people have written in and suggested, the story of a daughter or the story of a whole new character, right? Like, right, outside of IP rights, outside of Sony greenlighting a game that has Kratos as the lead character again. But I'm curious, Patrick, for you, like, that first half of that game is just a constant, for me, was like, just like, oh, fuck off, Kratos. Like, put a hand on your son's shoulder. Like, tell him it's okay to be upset sometimes. Like, you know that stuff's true because you've been through it. Two, you must have not been this big of an asshole at some point in your past because you managed to, like, marry Faye and have a kid with her. And I, based on all of the representation that she has in secondhand stories about her, she doesn't seem like the sort of person who would be, like, into your grumbly asshole bullshit. So that stuff was hard for me, even though I also know it was the kind of point of the story that they were setting up, to go from completely toxic, you know, shitty dad to, well, son, we did it, we're friends now. You know, like, that arc definitely seems to be intentional. But how about for you? How did you relate to Kratos outside of, I have this responsibility?
Well, my dad murdered the Greek pantheon.
Okay, well.
So for me, I can't speak for other writers. This is not something I got into my review, but, like, so as someone that, you know, my daughter's 18 months, you know, almost two, and, you know, I think a lot about my dad in relation to my daughter because it's natural to think about your parents when you're raising a kid, but also the generation that, and I see this reflected in a lot of my friends and, like, how their fathers treated them when they were growing up, like, it was just not a world where, like, men were, like, sensitive or talked to their kids. Like, you'll hear lots of stories where, like, sons and, or probably daughters and fathers actually have, like, real conversations about things, like, when they're much, much older and, like, things about, like, end of life and just, like, it's a different relationship at that point. And my dad was a very good person. He was a loving father. He just never expressed anything like that. Like, I probably don't think my dad ever told me that he loved me, even though I definitely know that he did. He expressed that in different ways, but it was not something that ever came out of his mouth. Like, there's a good story of when I was 16, right after I got my first car accident and, like, nearly totaled the car. I was coming out of a, I was going back during my curfew, which was midnight at the time, or 11:30 or something like that. And it was at my first girlfriend's place, and I was like kind of racing to get back, and it was lightly raining. And so when I was coming off of the red light, I just came out too hard. Like, I didn't like go, you know, 0 to 60, but I went fast enough that I hydroplaned. And you read about hydroplaning, and they tell you what you're supposed to do when you hydroplane, which is, you know, where your car gets slick on the wheels, and you're supposed to like tap the brake and like turn in the opposite direction. But like, fuck, man, when you're hydroplaning, it's scary as shit.
Yep.
So I ended up like going off the road and like completely like fucking up the left side of the car against a telephone pole, which clearly could have gone a whole lot worse and been a much worse situation. And this is before cell phone, so I had to walk like two blocks to get to a payphone to call my parents, collect. I didn't have any change to call them with. And so I called my parents, collect, explained that I was in an accident. And like, this was the kind of thing where like my dad hated when like we started driving. It like, he was a safety nut, and like to not be in control, like, just really drove him up a wall. And so I figured like, oh, this is it. Like I never have actually feared that my dad would ever hit me. He's not that kind of person, but like, fuck, like, I fucked up. This car is in horrible shape. Like, this is, I'm either grounded for eternity or some sort of belt is coming out. And he came over, like, we took care of it, and he never said anything.
Right.
Not a one. He just took care of it. And I remember asking my dad or my mom like a week later, like, what the hell, mom? Like, okay, when does the hammer drop? Like, I've gotten in trouble for like small things, and like, here's the big thing, and like, nothing. She's like, look, honey, your father's just happy you're safe and that you called and everything got taken care of, and that's how he shows that he loves you. And I was like, well, nobody likes super cool if like he just fucking told me that. And so it's moments like that, like, that's where I found my way into this relationship between Kratos and Atreus. Was like, when my father passed away 5 years ago, like, we were on wonderful terms. The last conversation we had was him dropping me off to meet with my friends to go on my bachelor party. My dad passed away about a month before I got married, and so that part sucks. But like, I had very good memories of the last interaction with my dad. I had a very good relationship with him, but it was not one that ever, like, I never got to have that moment that people talk about that I'm very jealous of like, what happens when parents and children get older. And so in my mind, I was like, I've always thought as a parent, like, I don't want that to happen to my kid. I don't want them to ever have to think about that, to feel that way, to never be a question. And it wasn't a question for me, but I had to do some inferring that I don't want to happen to my daughter and what other kids I eventually have. And so that's what I saw a lot in Kratos and Atreus, was like a father learning to be like sensitive and empathetic and to express themselves. And although I'm starting from a position far different than Kratos, like, just like, you know, the weird, like, what it's like to be in public with a kid as a father, like, as a man, like, the expectations that go into that, the way those things are changing. Like, I just, there's a lot going on, at least from my perspective, being like a young male father in 2018, and like, what that arc of Kratos and watching him learn to verbalize his emotions, as like shitty as they often were, was something I saw myself in a much different light, and like, wanting that to be something that I don't want to be Kratos. Like, I want that something that like my daughter knows, you know, from day one.
Right.
And so that was ended up being my, like, I get what that person is saying. Like, fuck, like, he's so violent, and like, the things he's teaching are bad. Like, I agree with you, like, 100%. Like, you're right. Now, that's why, like, talking to folks about how they can't get over the hump on this game, like, what I ended up doing, and I think this is true for a lot of people, is like, seeing for it, like, what it gave back to you, or like, your way into it, as opposed to necessarily looking at it 100% as like the story of Kratos and Atreus. It's like the story of Kratos and Atreus, and then also you and how you play into that. Uh-huh. And I think that's going to vary based on the player. Like,
right.
That's going to vary based on what you bring to it. And maybe that's not universally true for everyone, but that's where I came from in finding my way to that relationship.
Well, so like, it's one of those things that frustrates me is that we don't get enough of that second thing, that kind of the second step, the third step, the final step of Kratos becoming the sort of father who you would want to be. It's part of why I'm so frustrated by the sort of synthesis between those two positions, is because it ends up being something still closer to who Kratos was originally than to what Atreus demands, which is someone who is opener, or who is much more open, who is affectionate. And like, you know, the kind of big final, one of the big final moments, the two big final moments in that game are you're going up the mountain. One, Kratos says basically, like, I don't have anything to hide anymore, and takes off the bandages that have been hiding the scars from the old chains of chaos, blades of chaos chains that have like burnt his arms, right? And he's like, it's you know, symbolic, right? Like, oh, I'm open now. Right. I'm willing to show that I'm wounded and that I have a history of violence and like all of that. But like, and then the other thing is that he lets Atreus carry the ashes and share in the release of them over the field, or over the kind of valley at the top. And he puts a hand on his shoulder, right? And it's like, all of those things are still within the realm of traditional Western masculinity. Do you know what I mean? Right. Like, the one hand on shoulder is like about as good dad as anything in the 1950s would show you. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what you would.
That's like at the end to like a season of Mad Men. Like, right. Oh, this right. drunk cheating asshole could also be good to his kid.
Could also put a hand like on him. Right. Like, we don't even see him lift his son in the air and toss him in the air. We don't even see like a deep embrace. We don't even see, let alone what I would love to see, which is like, I almost want the Red Dead thing here, right? Which is like, show me them in domesticity for a little bit. Show me them just like living a life, and I want to see what Kratos is like when Atreus fucks up again, because he's a kid and he's gonna fuck up. That's the part that, like, we get the opposite. We get Atreus becoming the bratty teenager who literally stops responding to your button presses, which is like a kind of cheap but also good thing, like a good yes. maneuver of like, I'm hitting the fucking shoot button and he's not shooting. But we get the, like, we don't get the next, we don't get the alternative of that, which is like, I want to see Kratos pushed to good parental figure, good mentor, good father, good like person who is more than just like, all right, well, I guess we're partners in this whole exploration and adventuring shit now, and now we're friends also, as well as being dad and son. Like, I want to see what that actually looks like, because if the idea is that you're presented a model not to be, which is the closed off, angry, kind of fascistic, or like at the very least emotionally abusive Kratos at the top of the game, we just don't get to spend any time with, and to some degree this is a problem with these sorts of stories and the ways in which stories weigh kind of redemption stories are about getting you to a state of redemption, not at showing what the value of improvement and redemption, or at least here the value is now you can super shoot fucking Baldur by the end of that game. Let me just hit square like four times in a row and Baldur doesn't have a fucking chance because Atreus is a dope fighter by the end of that game. And like, that's not, there's no great takeaway there, you know?
Yeah, and I, if it doesn't, you know, I think we talked about in a Waypoint Radio conversation about like, you know, Sony does a lot of DLC for these, you know, these games. My guess is they're going to do some sort of like major expansion that comes out, you know,
right,
8 months from now, like probably something later this year or early next. I hope rather than off to do another epic battle, although I'm sure it'll have like some epic battles, that I would love if like that's what the DLC focused on, was like just like mundane. Like,
right.
It was like, okay, now that, you know, Ragnarok seems like that's going to be, whether it's the next game or the game after that, like that's clearly the end game for a lot of like the storytelling that they're setting up. Like, I'd love if like the DLC was actually not super action focused or bombastic, but was actually just like lets them live in like the new reality that
Did you get the secret ending? Did you see the secret ending?
Is that where you go back to the house?
Yeah, you go back to the house.
I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
So what happens at the house?
You go back to the house, you like put your stuff down, you toss Mimir on the bed, you each get into bed and like, it's like sleep, and like in all your armor you lay down on a pillow, and then it goes like 3 years later, 2 years later. It just actually doesn't say that. Oh. It just says years later. And it's like storming out and it's thunder and lightning, and the lightning like smashes through the roof, and you get up and you get your axe and you open the door and there's Thor. Or presumably, yeah, it's Thor, because it like zooms in and it's just like a shadowy figure wearing a cloak, and at his waist, like holstered like a fucking revolver, is Mjolnir, the like lightning hammer. Right. He like literally does like a quick draw style, like finger like pose, like his hand goes out next to it, he like pulls back his cloak to reveal the hammer. So like, I get it, like Thor hangs heavy over this game. Thor very much is like,
it's also years later, though, right? So maybe there is an opportunity for them to do something like a DLC that's in between.
Yes, totally.
Because it just seems like, and I don't know what the plan is. Like, there was Jason Schreier and Kirk Hamilton interviewed Corey Barlog over on Kotaku, and like Corey said that he is like, yeah, kind of sketched out like roughly five games. That doesn't mean they're making another five. It's just that, like, you know, somewhere on a board is like, here are the major beats that we could do for five of these games. One, that's a lot of God of War games.
That's too many God of War games.
And even Corey has said that, you know, like,
right.
I'm sure lots of people plan out a timeline that is a lot more than what they actually end up doing, stuff like that can condense. That neither here nor there. It's more just, we talked about this, I think both in the stream and in a podcast, was about, like, it just only seems like the story can escalate from here. And that seems to go against, like, my very favorite. Like, what? Like, this game was purposely isolated so they could try and avoid some of that stuff. And I don't know how they're going to do that, or if they'll be able to avoid doing that the second time around, because that's what I actually want, is just like more isolation with those characters, doing more mundane things. It's just, I don't know how they're going to avoid that. I hope they can surprise me, because I'd be interested to see, you know, kind of where they take Atreus. From here, I know that, like, the reveal that he's Loki, like, was supposed to be like an oh my god, but like, maybe I don't know enough to, like, why I was supposed to be like, is it just because that's like weird for the timeline, or is that the cyclical stuff, like, why is it a big deal?
It is weird because of some of the stuff Loki gets up to historically. Or I mean, like, in terms of, like, I'm pretty sure the World Serpent is his child? Yes, that's correct. Oh. The World Serpent is Loki's child. Like,
he's the father of the belly of his son.
Yeah. That's a thing that happened. Hell is Loki's child. Right, there's like lots of weird stuff around that around Loki. So who knows? Like, at this point, like, that reveal is like, okay, like, we're in the fucking wilds now. Like,
right.
Whatever they're going to do, they're going to do. I'm going to be here to hear. I'm curious about where it goes. Like, you just have to kind of buckle up and go for it. You can't just, like, all right, cool. Also, it pays off. Can I turn into animals? Because, yes, Loki can turn into animals. Is that, like, one of the first things that Atreus is like, can I turn into animals? I'm like, yes, yes. Like, Loki historically, not historically, but mythologically, absolutely turned into various animals. That stuff, the Loki thing didn't really, I don't know. That was like a goofy reveal to some degree, because it felt like it was so, it was just like almost like process of elimination. Like, all right, whose name is a character? Who is a character whose name hasn't come up and who would be known to a wide enough audience because they've seen the Marvel movies?
And making Loki a child when most people's like popular culture perception of him is like, you know, an older brother that's been around for
Other thing is that, like, Loki is not the brother of Thor in Norse mythology,
right.
So, like, I'm curious how many people finished that game was like, oh, does that mean that actually Thor is also Kratos's, like, what is the, like, do people know that Loki is not Thor's brother in Norse mythology? And how does that studio deal with that in a weird way, knowing that their audience thinks that because they've all seen the Thor movies and the Avengers movies? You know, like, it's a...
Yeah, you almost can't, like, tell these stories without realizing that, like, yeah, most people's perception of that whole world is severely tainted by how it's been rolled out by Marvel for the last 10 years.
Right, right. And you know, maybe there is some side story where in which that is a thing that's suggested, and it isn't just a thing that, or you know, maybe they're just adopted brothers or something in the Marvel Universe movies. Maybe that's all it is. So who knows? I don't know. It's like, it was one of those things where, like, I felt the moment of releasing the ashes worked for me. Pretty much. It's just, I didn't think it would be, on one hand, I was so happy to be done because I did not like the final act of that game. The final, like you said, 5 to 10 hours felt like it was a bit of a slog. I really hated that second Return to Hell in terms of mechanics, that, like, boat,
the flying ship
stuff was, like, so exhausting. And I was just like, it's not challenging. It's not making me do anything interesting in the combat. I'm fighting the same enemies.
Okay, we're in another combat sequence. Like, fight them off again until
the
fire moves your ship again.
And then you know, even beyond that, it was just about, like, they switched to lore dump. They switched to, like, oh, this is the realm of giants. Your mother must have been a giant. And also, here's, like, there's this old mural, and the mural looks like it's going to be sad because it was like, oh, I want all this to be contextualized through Mimir, you know, kind of posturing or at least interpreting. And instead, we don't get that stuff because, you know, that game isn't made yet. You know, like, I'm sure they've got
One thing they do that I really liked was the way the game handles, like, the post game, like the post ending. You know, obviously you get dumped back into the world, and you can see, like, you know, they, you know, part of Ragnarok is, like, there's a, like, it's a long winter,
yes,
or an eternal winter,
yes,
or whatever the thing. And the characters comment on that. Like, it was cool to actually have the game finish, and then with the Mimir starts telling stories about Ragnarok,
yes,
and contextualizing a little bit of what happened in, like, the final moments in the ending, and, like, what could possibly come next, in a way that I thought was, like, oh, this is, like, a really cool way to handle, like, oh, you're still playing, like, a bunch of more hours.
We have
but
content.
Clearly there was
a
setup for a sequel,
right,
and, like, ignoring that is kind of weird. So instead of ignoring it, they actually kind of wrap it into the way Mimir, like,
tells stories. Yeah, that was cool. In general, I'm at such a weird place because on one hand, by the end of that game, I didn't want to do any more side stuff. I was so done with, like, I wanted to see the conclusion. I wanted to see the payoff for the stakes that they had set up. But on the other hand, some of my favorite moments, so many of my favorite moments were those little character moments, little storytelling moments, and then some of the side content, the side mission or the side arc with the dragon that was chained up, the side arc with the dwarven alchemist, like all of those little side bits to me were as strong as the main story stuff.
Did you do the one where Atreus makes a deal with, the person who says, if you find my wife,
yes,
you can talk to your mother
again.
And then
like, I mean,
obviously that doesn't work
out.
That was a good way of setting up an otherwise, like, sort of innocuous, like, combat encounter.
Yeah, that one didn't work for me so much because I knew that it did not. I was like, this is just going to be a Revenant fight. Like, this is just
if they're
going to
do this, they're not going to do it in a side
quest. No, exactly. But, like, what if they had? Think about that. Think about the thing where it was like, all right, you get to talk to her. Okay. She's dead. Like, that to me is like, you get to talk to her, you say your words, and then we're still here. We still have to finish
right.
this quest. Like, almost would have been, or maybe you do with that's my cynical read on it, right? Is like the Kratos, or what if it's a different response based on which Kratos you are when you do that, right? Imagine the world in which you get to see his mother again, and she gets to appear for this one side quest and says something, and Atreus says something and turns back to his father. And Kratos, at the beginning of the game, is like, all right, she's dead. We knew that, boy. Like, let's keep going. We still have to go do this thing. That doesn't change anything. Versus the endgame one, which could have been, like, the open-hearted version, you know?
Right.
That could have been neat.
It's also, like, the way we were talking about, like, the lack of sort of, like, if not emotionally vulnerable, then just, like, more a progressed, like, arc to where they're clearly trying to take Kratos in the direction they're trying to move him, even if he doesn't move that far, is, like, weirdly... So, like, the photo mode that they're rolling out in the next couple of weeks, where you can change the faces of both Kratos, or at least Kratos, and, like, specifically you can make him smile, is both, like, extremely funny, extremely good, and also kind of, like, damning a little bit, because not that you expect Kratos to, like, smile, that seems slightly...
But no, it shouldn't, that's the whole thing. He should be able to fucking smile by the end of that game.
Well, if he doesn't, like, lift Atreus up at the end and, like, dangle him and throw him around, like, even just a like a chuckle out of Kratos would have been like spoken volumes about like where he was. And so I found originally seeing that I was kind of laughing. I was like, well, it's funny because it's so against character, and yet it's so against character because he actually didn't move that far.
He didn't move that far. Like, it's frustrating for me. I grew up with a father who I loved.
Because the smile is what you wanted Kratos to end with, and we actually didn't get it. You just put it in the photo mode.
This is the other thing, is that even I grew up with a father who I loved dearly, who I love dearly now, but who I was also, for a large period of my childhood, terrified of, right? Like, terrified of. He's 6'8". He's a big dude. He... you know, I maybe was physical with me a couple of times, but absolutely leveraged the threat of his physicality. And did that wildly in life. And has since confronted that and become a much, much better person who I love deeply, who I have a deep affection for. Even as a child, even when he was at his most, like, emotionally aggressive, even when he was the most willing to be physically intimidating and threatening to people, I always remember his laugh. I always remember his smile. And now it's what I remember the most about. Now that I have a good relationship with him, a really strong relationship with him, now that I've seen him change and become a really complete and joyful, and you know, he still gets frustrated. He's a person. People are allowed to be angry. But now that he's someone who has kind of not just mellowed out, but confronted and addressed the issues he had as a young man, it's what I remember so clearly about him is his laugh and his smile and his ability to be funny and joyous on top of being, you know, frustrated at a computer or upset about politics or about, you know, he's a Cleveland Browns fan. I've seen him mad his whole life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, rather than anger being the defining trait, anger is part of a spectrum of emotions that one expresses to react to the world.
In a bunch of different ways, including sometimes in a grin, in a, like a gallows humor. Man, fuck this. I can't fucking believe
this. You can't be a Browns fan without it.
You can't be. Exactly. His best friend is a Steelers fan. So, you know, like that's it's bad. Yeah. Yeah.
That's been like the Bears Packers. It's like, whoa, some friends we used to text back and forth and FaceTime with, the talk shit before a game. And then it was just like, yo, it's not fun to do anymore. You just beat
us.
Every time.
Right. So, like, and that's the thing, is like, the game should have found space for Kratos to crack jokes and laugh at them a little bit more. They do here and there on the side stories, here and there. But there should have been space for him to grin and to, like roll his eyes at Sindri and Brock?
Brock, yeah. Well, even if he did so privately, right? Like, what if, because it would make sense that you would see an evolution in Kratos' character that he didn't want to express or know how to express or be vulnerable with his son. But if there were little moments where he found the facade breaking privately, and then the payoff for that is it being expressed publicly.
Or even publicly, privately with his son, right? Like, the thing that a good, like, you and I have this, Patrick, where we go to an appointment at an event and we're just straight-faced. And then we walk away and it's like, yo, that was wild. That, like, that person was super rude or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, you and I will privately
laugh. Do they really mean that we're going to buy an Xbox One X for fucking Minecraft in 4K?
Right, exactly.
In the meeting. Ooh, the lighting. You know, the lighting does look better.
The lighting does look better. Right. But that's what friends do. It's what parents do. Parents do open up, or not all parents, obviously. I think there are, but by the grace of the gods, there's a different world in which my father and I don't have a great relationship now. I know people who my mom was disowned by her parents for years because she was with my dad. Like, I know the way this goes, and I know that not all parents are fucking good people and don't always do great things. But when a relationship between a parent and a child often can include a sort of sharing of who of a self that is a little more vulnerable, does have in jokes, that does have familiarity. Like, the word familiarity comes from family, you know? And so it would be great to have seen a little bit more of that. I know that, like, it's funny, it's a spoiler cast, but we're not hitting a lot of, like, independent little moments. We're not saying, wasn't it great the time that Freya noticed the mistletoe arrow and threw them away and broke them. We're not talking about the time when Atreus found out about being a god and got onto the boat, and there was this, like, long extended sequence of Kratos dragging the boat from Freya's house back to the river. We're not talking about the river sequence where Kratos is rushing back to get the chains. Like we're I think this game does encourage or demand that we talk about things in these bigger thematic ways instead of those little ways, because those little ways have to serve something. And if they're not serving something really well, then like all the game is left to hang on is its combat, which is enjoyable, and is and the environments, which are beautiful. Like I do think it's a beautiful game, but like mm-hmm. I just wish all of those little moments added up a little bit more for me to something that where there was a takeaway of Kratos as a figure who did move more than a little bit, right? Basically, this is just coming back to what you said in the throwaway, you know, a few minutes ago for like one sentence, which is Kratos only moved a little bit. You know, Atreus moves a lot compared to where Kratos moves. And I wish both of them.
And also, it's hard to tell where, like, if this game is also functions as like meta commentary from the developers, like, you know, a lot of the original developers, as I noted in my review, and I'm sure when it was noted elsewhere, a lot of the original developers that worked on like God of War 1 and 2 specifically came back to work on this one. I'm not sure the game necessarily comes down very explicitly one way or the other on Kratos. Like, certainly, like, it's a story about redemption or change at the very least, but both functionally through the game's exposition and storytelling and then sort of on a meta level, like, it's not super explicit where everything falls.
Right. Totally.
One small thing that I really liked – because I remember mentioning it in a previous conversation, but not being explicit about it, was I loved the explanation they came up for why there are shops everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like they have to have a reason for you to be able to upgrade, especially because yes. they don't let you fast travel at any point. And like even when – though you can go back to Brock at all times, back at Tyr's Palace or whatever, those are like you find
those – I love those moments.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But you always find the shops in like weird spots that don't make a lot of sense. There's almost always like a throwaway line that's like, what are you? Even once you know like the actual like in canon explanation, which is just like, yeah, we can slip between realms yeah. and just like show up places. There's a time where they make like a really explicit joke about it. It was like, why didn't you help us? Or
right.
But yeah, like they constantly reference that joke and riff on it.
When you're going up to the mountain for the first time, the first mountain. Sindri shows up and it's like, we just did the whole thing with the elevator and like with all that shit. Like, how did you get? And he's like, oh, we have ways of getting places. Like, we can slip through the realms in a way that you guys can. If I could have taken you, I would have taken you. Yeah, obviously.
It's hand wavy, but in a way that I felt like it was funny and it worked. And it was like it spoke to in the same way, like the little bits of the conversation and how they handle breaking that up. It's people who have played a lot of video games realizing the gamey parts of a game and then finding clever ways to explain it or contextualize it. And like that, like the way they explain that is it's fine. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's kind of like whatever, but it's a whatever that's both funny and they don't ignore it. Like they don't pretend it's not weird. Like it is weird. And instead they just confront it and then come up with like a funny
explanation. The realms and small holes were dwarves, whatever. Yeah, like sure, that's all you need. I really like it's funny. I think about them and I think a lot about the Atreus stuff with Sindri. Once Atreus is like, I'm a god and you're below me. That stuff was so rough, man. I was like, yo, Kratos, come get your kid. You cannot let him be like this. You know better.
And Mimir does. Yeah. Like Mimir then starts functioning as this, you know, like referee that is just like Kratos. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell you, but I'm going to tell you. Like, you can't let this keep.
Right.
Keep going. Like, your wife isn't here anymore. Right. Like, this is just you now.
Do better. So really quickly before we wrap, or maybe not that, who knows, we'll see where this conversation goes. I did want to touch on, someone did write in about this. This is the same question about the toxic masculinity of Kratos. Kind of said, like, hey, isn't there an interesting parallel here, too, between kind of Kratos's idea of stoic masculinity, of, like, don't open your heart, do what's necessary, don't bend, right? Just push through. And some of what has come out around Corey's talking around the labor of this game, right? Mm-hmm. There had been that viral video of Corey Balrog going around saying, you know, we all sacrificed so much while making this game. We all crunched, basically, right? I forget the exact quote that was in that video, but basically was like,
is this the one where before he watches like or reads the reviews?
Yes,
of the game
that video. And it's in that video where he's like, you know, responding to the reviews that are so positive, where he says, you know, we've been crunching so hard for the last few months. So we've been, you know, long days, blah, 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 blah. And then Corey went on Giant Bomb and talked to Brad over there. And Brad asked, you mentioned, you know, like 5+ years of work, you know, people being there at 3 a.m. and stuff like that. I feel like labor and game development has become kind of a hot topic as of late. Do you have any thoughts on how you guys handled things in retrospect now that you're on the other side of it? Like, how did you handle that? Which is, from Brad, like a pretty open-ended question, but, you know, he's like, hey, can we talk about crunch, basically, you know? And Corey's response is, I mean, it's a tricky thing for us. We depend on the passion of the people there, right? When I was talking about what our studio used to be, this idea of my second week in the studio, I was at the studio 3 a.m. burning a TGS demo disc because I cared, not because anybody else asked me to be there. In fact, there were probably 25 people there and none of them needed to be there. There just needed to be one person there just to burn the disc. But we were all staying because we were so excited. We finished God of War 2 and we stayed until 2 or 3 a.m. burning, you know, gold candidate discs. And then instead of just playing for the 2 minutes to test it at work, we played for an hour and a half because everyone was around, we was playing and we cared and we just were really into it. And I think it was a similar thing that while we all go through our ups and our downs and people have doubts, I think at its heart, when everyone starts seeing what we're making, it's something special. It just feels like everybody puts so much into it. And he goes on and on and on from there. And, you know, talks about how he kind of does the thing of like, well, It's we all decided to want to do this. We all wanted to push ourselves that hard. He does later say, like, everybody's working their butt off to trying to do something great. And it's even more painful when it's not great. And I mean, I've worked on my share of really crappy games, right? And kind of says, you know, when you look around and you see Red Dead's coming out and you see all these other things, like, you just want to push yourself until it's the very best. And it was really frustrating to some degree. I wasn't surprised to hear that. That is a position to sort of like, we've decided to crunch together is one of those things that you see come out kind of often. We ran a story from Tanya Short, who's an independent game dev, back when we launched, about like, why do game devs decide to crunch? Where does this internal, it's a passion project argument come from? And why is it not enough to accept that argument, or to, why is it more complicated than that argument makes it seem? And it is, you know, to the person who wrote in and said, basically, isn't it interesting to see this parallel between these two things? I don't know if there's like a complete overlap there, but the idea of like this synthesized version of stoic fatherhood but like passionate dad does have this weird overlap with the sort of like, well, when you love something, you just give it your all and you just push forward. And I don't think that there's like a, I don't think it's that deep, quote unquote, right? But it was frustrating to me, and it is still frustrating to me to think about, given the year we're having, in which game developers are taking seriously the idea of unionization and organization and pushing back, and the year in which we've now seen Sony, you know, file the same 2 PR press releases about bad conditions in their workplaces, which were like, we take it very seriously. This is the two being Naughty Dog and Quantic Dream, which were not about crunch, but more about sexual harassment situations. It is frustrating to not have that question answered much more directly, right? Which is like, hey, person who is in a big position, in a major position, who has a platform because you have one of the biggest games of the year releasing, not where do you stand, but like, what do we do about the fact that a God of War only comes out because you need 5 years, during which many of those years, or much of that time, I don't have insider information about how long crunch was going on or anything like that, but during where some of that time includes incredibly long days, includes distance from family. You know, this is a game about family, but we know what working conditions are in this industry. And again, it's about separating people from their families and requiring them to be the 25 people in a room where you only need one person, you know, or in which there is a sort of pressure to be that person and a culture that demands you be the person who says, oh, no, I'm just passionate about it. I didn't expect more, but I would have loved to have seen more. And I would love to see leaders like people in Corey's position push for the industry to confront this and actually change, you know?
Yeah, I don't expect, in no world was he going to, partially for his own career, partially because I just have low expectations, saying like, he was not going to comment on unionization advocate for, that's just not.
I wish we had that person in the industry. Like, I do. I wish we had someone in a AAA space who was willing to do that.
Especially because, I don't expect it, but I do think Corey, especially having launched this game, like, was in, like, a prime position to make the sort of, like, strong, like, what are they going to do, fire Corey Balrog and, like, not let him make another God of War? Like, people would fucking riot. Like, he was in the strongest possible position, which is immediately after the game when everyone is, like, in the glow of enjoying it, that, like, you can make those kinds of statements and use that as leverage going forward. So in some... Mm-hmm. But I say, specifically about unionization, I don't hold as a knock because I just don't expect that from sort of entrenched game developers, especially ones that are in... I mean, Corey's in a management position. You know, he's not in senior, you know, a Sony executive, but he is in a management position as being the creative director or whatever his official title is. But there's a way in which he could have phrased that question in which he said, or his answer, in something that was like, I and teams I've been on have been screwing this up for a very long time. Like, we were away from our families for too long. We screwed it up on this project. We screwed it up on previous projects. And he's like, how do you make a game about families without thinking about this more? He's like, the next project we have to do better. We're actually like doing a post analysis where we're like talking through the team, what worked, what didn't work. How do we change things? How do we get people out of the office that don't need them in the office? A huge part of crunch for big teams. I was just talking to someone that, you know, is working on a huge release for in the fall about this, is that they have nothing to do with the main development. They're part of ancillary to the company. It's important, but it's something that will ramp up as the game is closer to release as opposed to, like, working on levels. And yet, they are at the office every single night until 11 p.m. because it is just expected that if you are working on this massive game that you are going to be there. And it's because the CEO of the company is there. It is not like upper management is just disappearing. Like, everyone is there. Right. But there's no one that is thinking about the quality of life for the team. There's no one saying, you don't need to be here. Sometimes they're going to be late nights. This isn't your night. Go home.
Right.
Like, there's no reason that you need to show solidarity by being here. But there's an expectation. There's a social pressure that happens with this. And I think
there's like a replacement you should show solidarity. And that should be about organizing to make sure people are paid well and that those conditions are established so that you don't feel like you need to stay there. That's the solidarity that you need. Not the solidarity of like, sit around here, stay here and do your work until midnight, even though you don't actually need to.
Yeah, reading Reddit while everyone else is, you know, doing the stuff that they need to do. Like, that's not showing solidarity. It is in the sense that, like, that's how the games industry has built itself.
Right, that's still showing solidarity to the brokenness of the games industry, though. Like, I get it. I get where it comes from. I do understand.
I have problems with the examples that Corey uses because, like, holy shit, of course people would want to stay late
on
when you're pressing the gold disc.
Of course,
like,
on that day. No one. That's not what people are mad
about.
That's
not what Crunch is. Crunch is, like, fixing a fucking audio bug that, like, cropped up just as you were about to leave work and you need to finish it because that's, like, part of, like, the press demo that's happening next week, right? Like, that's different than, like, celebrating the finality of this thing that's been a part of your life for years. And I just wish he could have found a way to reflect – to have contextualized that and say that we didn't do it right this time. We need it's also being forthright to know, like, it's gonna probably not be perfect the next time either. That's unfortunately the systemic nature of the toxic culture that is game development. But we love this thing so much. So how do we do it better so it's sustainable and that we want to keep making these games when we're in our 40s and 50s and 60s? And that's not, that's only going to be possible for a select few that made enough money that they can afford to work normal hours and not kill themselves while doing it. Or worry that just because you want to work normal hours, you're going to be replaced by like some 21-year-old that is just desperate to get a job and will come in and do the thing. Like, no disrespect to the 21-year-old, you know, hustle, do your thing. But like, that's the hatchet that hangs over everyone's head is like the moment that you like decide to like live a normal life is like, oh, well, they're just going to replace you with someone who will just do it.
Totally. Well, and the thing here too is like, it is so much about how you address this stuff after you've done it and like what steps you try to take to make sure it's not the case going forward, right? Where, so we did that, we've been doing reviews lately, right? At Waypoint, you may have seen them. And we were talking about Patrick's God of War review today, right? And so a couple of months ago when Far Cry 5 came out, I was reviewing Far Cry 5. And because of the way the game went and because of just how my schedule went as EIC, sometimes I have to be in meetings and stuff and not, it's been hard for me to be like, all right, what I'm going to do today is just play this game, right? And so I played that game at night, which is part of, you know, what is like across the culture of games journalism. If you're a reviewer, it is not often that you like, the thing I'm going to do main time, like, or especially not if you're a reviewer, if you're assigned to review at this point, very few people except for freelancers are just reviewers. You're also doing other sorts of content. And in my role, it means being in meetings or doing podcasts or doing streams or whatever, right? And so while I was able to like, kind of move things around a little bit to make sure I could play during the day sometimes, I mostly played at night.
If you get 90 minutes in, you're like, ha-ha, right, victory. I played right. 90 minutes of a 20-hour game right,
during
the day.
During my actual work day. But then when it came time to write the review, it was just one of those ones that was like a hard one to get out there. It was a big, weird review. And so I ended up pulling an all-nighter. One, I would be the worst boss ever if I had made a culture here that was like, well, I'm going to be up all night writing this review. I hope everybody else is around. Please hang out in the office with me so that you can like keep my spirit, which isn't what happened. I'm not saying Corey did that, but I'm saying that the culture of games is such that it feels at those studios in question like a bad thing that you would go home while someone else is working on an audio bug, or while if there are 30 people in the office and 10 of them have to stay, the idea that another 15 of them need to stay too is already like absurd, let alone the fact that it's already absurd that we work with such tight schedules and with such high demand that crunch is necessary. Like that does come down to management issues and scheduling issues and timeline issues and over, and you're trying to say that you can do more with less, you know, and not being honest about what what the scope and likelihood of problems is, like that we have people, we've spoken to too many developers who say that that's what it comes down to. But second to that is just like, as soon as that was done, there was the next morning, we were talking about streaming stuff, and Danica brought up that like she wasn't thrilled that I pulled an all-nighter for this thing. Like, we talk a lot about work-life balance, and my like off-the-cuff response, you know, at 8 a.m. after having pulled an all-nighter was like, it's part of the job. Like, and historically, it has been part of the job. Like, to be a game reviewer has meant, in my experience, that you pull some all-nighters. And there are times in your, by and large, our jobs are not that heavy of a lift, right? Like, I do a lot of stuff with my position. There's a lot to do. Obviously, we work full weeks. We work maybe more than people might think, but also less than lots of other jobs. We're not laying brick. You know what I mean? We're not digging right. holes. I know what we have. I'm talking to a microphone about God of War. Like, I get it. I know I got it. I don't know what y'all on, as it's, Kanye it's, West
take
once
it seriously,
said.
But don't take it seriously.
Right, exactly. But and there are times.
Talk about Kanye West. There's a lot. There's I know. A there's live TMZ interview.
I'm 12 minutes into the Charlemagne interview right now. I don't. It's a lot.
I'm not going to read you this quote because I think you might
just die. I know. Fucking. It's unbelievable. Anyway. So, but my point is, you know, historically in the industry of game journalism, we have these moments that are like, all right, it's E3. It's time to fucking go hard. It's review season. It's time to go hard. I'm not going to get a lot of sleep this season. I'm going to spend a lot of time playing these games. And to some degree, there is a limit to what I can change about that, right? Like, a 40-hour game comes out. For Patrick to review it, I need him to probably play 40 hours. But there are things that we can change around that. And so when God of War was coming out, Patrick, you and I had a talk, and it was like, you should play this game because the schedule is such that you have to get on a plane to PAX. We have to work at PAX. So we're gonna like play that game this week. Don't worry about not filing stuff. Like, yes, we'll be down. We'll be short on traffic that week because we won't have you writing news stories that week. That's okay. Play the game. Get yourself in a position to where you don't have to pull an all-nighter 2 weeks from now or a week and a half from now. Same thing with Rob and BattleTech. With that, it was like, you know, he was 30 hours into the game and hadn't beaten it yet. And it was like, well, do I pull an all-nighter here or do I write, hey, I'm X hours in my 30 hours or my 25 hours with BattleTech, blah, blah, blah. Write that. It's fine. Like, I don't need you killing yourself over this. Write what you've experienced. Be clear about what you've experienced. Patrick, take the time to actually review the thing. And so much of this is not like, I expect everybody to get it right immediately. It's what you just said, Patrick, which is like, come out and say we fucked up and then take the steps to address that.
Have a conversation about it. Because, I mean, that's – and I think something that, you know, like we had a – we really only seriously started talking about this stuff even at Waypoint, which is like, you know, a website we're like very, you know, forward-facing about like our politics and labor is a huge thing we talk about. And yet, like, it really wasn't until we had like a big group meeting in January where we like had like a really long, serious conversation about like – people's work hours.
You're burning out because we're all working 60 hours.
Specifically was me telling you, like, you set a bad example for everyone else based on the hours you work. We need to have a conversation where both you benefit and then everyone else benefits in the same way, where it's those late nights, like what you did with Far Cry is the exception to the
right,
rule.
The rule can't
stuff's
be.
Stuff's going
yes.
to happen. Right. Being like the most, even the most, you know, my kid doesn't sleep 8 hours every
and
night.
And I will
right?
say.
Like, she gets up and screams. Right. In the same way, like, eventually, sometimes you're going to have a thing you just got to get done and it happens. But that should be something where, like, oh, this just happens every once in a while right. because that's.
Because that's life.
That's
that does
life.
Happen in life. In all jobs, there are periods during which there is an excess of work to get done. And, like, every now and then you have to, you do make the exception and it sucks. One, you should be fairly compensated for that. Two, that shouldn't be the norm. And, like, last year this time at Waypoint, that was absolutely the norm. Like, 60, 70 hour work weeks. That was a week. That wasn't Far Cry 5 came out and I needed to do a review. That was just getting stories up on the site. That's like, if you go back and look at the amount of stories we were running a year ago, those were all like, we were editing all of those. We were up late editing. Like, there's so many nights where Danielle and I were just alone in the office editing stories. It was like me and her and my boss were the only people left because my boss has the same like terrible crunch work ethic that I do. But like, yes, we had that conversation and we improved on it. And like, I'm not at the office until 8 p.m. that often anymore. Again, once a week, once every other week, let alone 10, which is 11, which I'd used to be there till. And like, that has been such an improvement. And so like God of War, in a weird way, like, I don't want to say that improvement can't happen. You know what I mean? Like, I do think improvement can happen. And I think the first step towards addressing that is for people in the position like Corey's to start to destigmatize talking about it as a bad thing that we can fix. Like, I don't expect a Corey Balrog, I keep saying Balrog. Is it Balrog or Barlog? It is.
Well, now you've got me confused.
Yeah, I know.
Though I should know better.
Same.
Barlog.
Is it like the monster from Lord of the Rings? Is it like.
That's Balrog.
So it's not like Balrog.
It's not.
It's
like,
Barlog.
It's you switch the R and the L.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So like Corey. I don't expect
what
Corey Barlog.
Like Danica Harrod.
Like Danica Harrod.
Harrod.
I don't expect Corey to be like
Harlog.
You know, Game Workers Unite. Here is my badge. I'm all in.
No,
I don't expect it. Even though
he may not even believe
who
that.
The fuck.
Like
knows?
even if you don't,
at least begin the process
the unionization.
Of,
like
of
you, there's no like it's there's no world where I can. Okay, no, there is a world. But I'm saying, like, you can reconcile the idea that, like, okay, I don't think unionization is the path towards, like, making things better, but also say, like, it's fucked up that people are staying until, like, 4 in the morning, like,
right, I mean, that's what the,
7
that's
days
what,
a week for months.
Right, that is what these industries do traditionally with all manner of criticism. They say like, well, we don't need regulation on loot boxes. We'll just handle it internally. We don't need
right.
The government to come in and step in and start regulating games and doing governmental regulation and ratings. We'll just create the ESRB and do it internally. Like, that is what happens. So you can imagine someone in Corey's position thinking that that's the solution. That like, oh, we just need oversight committees inside of individual game companies that aren't necessarily about organized workers, blah, blah, blah. There are lots of ways to, but at the very least, talking about that as an issue does help to destigmatize the notion that we should be holding ourselves and holding the industry to be accountable for that additional work. Anyway, we had a much deeper dive on this than anticipated, but I think important. Important because, like, a game like this does not come along that often in terms of the response it gets.
Also, kind of a bummer, we were not offered an interview with Corey Barlog, but didn't really see anyone, like, ask him about any of the women
no.
stuff. Not to just call it women stuff, but, like, to give it, you well, know.
The history is misogyny, and, like, the fact that he, or the question of, like, hey, so, like.
Because my guess is he thought about it,
I hope.
I just want to know.
Right.
Yo,
right?
Okay, like you made the conscious choice. Like the game opens with her dead.
Right.
So, why? Like, how do you justify the lack of those voices?
Totally.
I didn't see a whole lot of discussion on them. If I missed it, like I've not watched the full interview. Like he's done
a bunch.
Six
I've not
or
seen
seven,
everything.
Spoiler cast. So, like, please, like, hit us up if like there have been quotes about that because I would definitely be interested to read. The answer is
totally.
But, like, I've not seen that in headlines pulled out anywhere.
Yeah, I think that is a really, you know, it's one of those things that's weird. We're on one hand, he's out there a lot. He's actually like he's been pretty visible for the director of a game. Like, normally we don't get this many deep dives and interviews afterwards, especially with something that's.
And he's a thoughtful guy.
Yes.
Like, you, like, I mean, like, that's, I think, probably what makes a lot of this stuff, like, more frustrating is it's one thing if you can just chalk it up to, like, what did you expect? And maybe that is still, like, the conclusion you could draw, but I surmise, like, based on my own interactions with Corey, that that he at least has thoughts on it, and I would just be curious to hear
what those are,
what they are, yeah. and why he arrived at the conclusions that he did, or the choices that he made in terms of how characters were or weren't represented.
Right. So. Right. All right. I think on that note, that is going to do it for us for this God of War spoiler cast. We will be back later this week with a regular episode of Waypoint Radio. I think for Friday, Danielle will be hosting, and we'll see where that takes us. Patrick, where can people find you on the internet?
Find me at Patrick Luffy.
Find me at Austin_Walker. You can find Waypoint, twitter.com/Waypoint, facebook.com/Waypoint Vice, youtube.com/Waypoint Vice, and twitch.tv/Waypoint. Hey, quick, we're recording this on the day that is the 1 year anniversary to our forums launching. Quick shout out to our mods over at the forums who today are doing a really big live stream, like 24-hour live stream celebrating the Waypoint community. Shout out to the mods at the forums, the mods at the, on our Discord, the Twitch mods. Those groups are all kind of working much more closely together these days. They do an incredible job. They have built such an incredible community. And I mean it. They've built it, right? Like, I've seen them live through and work through so many things that are like, you know, the influx of people after NeoGAF shut there, or after the exile of NeoGAF. I guess NeoGAF still exists. To moments when Waypoint has been at the center of criticism, and seeing them corral conversation in a way that is critical and thoughtful, and often, you know, sometimes critical of us and the way that we've handled things, while still making sure that it is coming from a place that's constructive and emotionally honest, and like, in general, creating a community that has at its core really great values. That all comes down to that team, which Danica manages and has kind of helped put together over the last year. It's something I'm really proud of, even though I'm really proud of having that the work that we've done at Waypoint has helped make that community, give that community a space to build itself, right? I don't want to take too much credit for it. You know what I mean? Like, we're in there for open threads. I comment on the BattleTech thread. I comment on other threads where it makes sense. But like, in the Discord, on the forums, the community has been so fantastic. So thank you to all the mods. Thank you to Danica. Thank you to everyone who's part of that community. As always, you can visit the community at form.waypoint.vice.com or discourse.zone. So thanks again for that. And thank you in general for being part of the extended Waypoint community. If you're listening to this, we get great questions. We have great, degrees of what's the word I'm lingering? That's not engagement. Engagement is such a shitty word. But what I mean by engagement is actually engagement. Like, not, oh, someone clicked on our website. Oh, someone watched our video. But so often the community is...
It's a caring.
It cares and is invested in these...
Invested is the right word. Until some social person comes around and
says investment rating or whatever. The community has always been invested and has given us a place to have conversations like these. There's nowhere I've ever worked before where I could have this conversation. And I love the places I've worked before. I'm not judging any of those places. But, you know, Patrick and I got to dig deep into some themes and ideas that otherwise would have been sidebar conversations or would have been smaller conversations. But here we got to kind of really dig in. And that's because I know that we're supported by the community and the people who are listening to this right now. So thank you so much for that. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And that is going to do it for us. Because Danielle isn't here, I guess I will say it. Be good. And you know what, Kratos? Listen the fuck up. Be good and be good at it. Peace.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.